Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to TV and film writer Nick Antosca. He's just published a collection of sometimes violent, sometimes sexy, sometimes bewildering short stories under the title The Girlfriend Game. Stick around. Nobody here gets out alive. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of aimless young people full of lust, anger, and amphibian genes in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. The only author less likely to get interviewed on Mr. Media than a short story writer is a poet. And it's taken 7 years for the first creator of short fiction to make it past the gatekeeper. So you poets listening shouldn't hold your breath waiting for your breakthrough moment anytime soon. Nick Antosca brings a cinematic storytelling style to his new short story collection, The Girlfriend Game, which is undoubtedly why I invested the time and energy to read it. The tales he tells grab you from the first page, spin you round and round, and sometimes don't let go even when you come out the other side. Now, that's not surprising when you discover that the talented Yale graduate has written for MTV's Teen Wolf adaptation, the short-lived ABC military drama Last Resort, and that he is currently writing for J.J. Abrams' new NBC show, coming in 2014, Believe. Antosca toys with boyfriend-girlfriend relationships in his title story, The Girlfriend Game, and man-dog relationships in Mammals, and human-alien relationships in Soon You Will Be Gone and Possibly Eaten. Folks, you'll get to the end of The Girlfriend Game, as I did, and wonder where the time went. Nick Antosca, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. Let's get right to the main question I have. Why short stories? I mean, they're not exactly the hot media of the moment.
Really, I think it's because I loved short stories when I was a kid. And Ray Bradbury, you know, the Martian Chronicles, which is arguably a novel, but really it's a collection of short stories. That was one of the collections, one of the pieces of writing that first got me into writing supernatural or speculative fiction, which is sort of the genre where I work. Mm-hmm. So really it's just the place that I've lived since I was a kid as a writer.
So more Ray Bradbury than Stephen Ambrose, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Ambrose, well, yeah. Ambrose Bierce, more Ambrose Bierce than Stephen Ambrose.
Ambrose Bierce. It shows you my respect for short stories that I'm confusing Stephen Ambrose and Ambrose Bierce. What are you going to do? What was the first short story that you wrote, though, and you thought, I can do this. This fits me.
The first short story I wrote was something I wrote in, I think, fourth or fifth grade. It was about, like, some seed pods that ended up in a suburban neighborhood, and they hatched, you know, and became – so it was, like, just a straight ripoff of Invasion of the Body Snatchers kind of thing. And I probably my first, like, three or four short stories that I wrote in elementary school were all just literal ripoffs of other things. But, you know, I think that's sort of in the tradition of almost all fiction writers. You start out inspired by something else or copying something else, and you find your own voice. I think Hemingway used to copy Chekhov stories word for word just to figure out how it was done, how it was put together. And I think that's actually a great exercise for writers of any kind.
Wait a minute. Hemingway overlapped with Star Trek? I thought he died before Star Trek.
Chekhov may have written short stories too, but he never published them.
So. Oh, you mean the original Russian Chekhov. I see.
Right, that guy.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. I'm just going to play dumb as long as I can get away with it here. How much, if any, reality seeps into your stories? For example, I read The Girlfriend Game and I think, okay, I could see that. I could see that actually happening to a guy, something similar. You know, amphibian, you know, maybe not so much.
Well, so for your viewers, The Girlfriend Game, the plot of the story, The Girlfriend Game, is a guy and his girlfriend play this sort of game in a bar where she pretends to be she pretends not to know him and let other guys approach her and hit on her, and then he comes up and steals her away, and you know, it's kind of a power game. That doesn't come I've never really done that, but a girlfriend and I discussed doing it, like, wouldn't that be weird if we did that once? And I was like, that's a good short story. And what would happen if we did that? And then what if she liked the other guy, you know, left with him? And that's the premise of the short story. You know, the main character gets the rug pulled out from under him. That's actually, that is the structure of a lot of the short stories in The Girlfriend Game. You know, somebody, actually, that's kind of the structure of a lot of fiction, period. You get the rug pulled out from under you.
Right.
So.
And amphibian, not...
No, my amphibian is about a guy whose mother turns into like a giant amphibious beast that lives in the pool in the backyard. I love my mother, Mom, if you're watching this, not about you. I know you have conflicted feelings about my stories, but that one, nothing to do with you.
You know, it's funny that you brought that up. I didn't think to ask you that, but I was just thinking about now that you said your mother has conflicted feelings about your stories. There's a woman who just published a novel this summer. It's called Tampa. I can't think of her name.
Oh yeah, Alyssa Nutting.
Yeah, and I'm in the Tampa Bay area, and it was made a bit of a splash here. But what was interesting to me was not so much that she ripped off a true story or any of that kind of thing, but that she. In the, I think it was in the dedication, she asked her parents not to read the story because, you know, it's so, you know, there are some things that you really don't want your mom to find out is going on in your head. I get that completely. How do you handle that?
I totally have it. I think most writers who write anything risque or weird have it. But I feel like ultimately it's a good thing because it forces you to. It forces you to not be embarrassed about your stories. I mean, there's something inherently embarrassing or troublesome about putting anything you write out in the world for anybody that you know to read. Oh, that's going on in his head. That weird. But my parents read most of my stuff, I think. I know they buy the books, but we don't really discuss it that much, and I know that they're proud and supportive of me being a writer, but we haven't discussed like the really sort of dark, weird stories. Better that I do that than be a drug addict or something. There's worse things than your kid writes dark stories.
Well, that's true. That's true. It's interesting. I have a daughter who's now 17, and until she started school, you know, I was still. I mean, I make my living as a writer, mm-hmm. and I would think about writing, or I did work on some things that were kind of risque, kind of adult, and then it sort of hit me that it really wouldn't go over very well with her friend's parents if they were dropping their kids off of here, and you know, this is the kind of thing that I was writing, and so I really backed away from any opportunity to do that over the years. And I wasn't so much worried about my mother at this point. I'm a little older than you. My mother's still around. I'm not worried about that so much. But I actually had to worry about this generation of parents of my daughters. Now, she's going to graduate this year. I'm going to worry about that a lot mm-hmm. less going forward. You know, I'm not babysitting anybody's kids anymore.
I don't have kids. If I have kids eventually, I feel like they'll be of a generation that has so much access to so much content of all kinds that I won't worry at all about them ever seeing anything I wrote. I mean, I'm like the last generation that grew up because I graduated from high school in 2000, I think. And I didn't, you know, we had the internet at back then, but it was still like internet 1.0 or like 1.5, right? Like it wasn't a given that everybody had an email address. My brother is 12 years younger than me. I feel like his generation has access to everything on the internet. I mean, there's no way you could go online as a teenager and not see porn, right? There's just no way. So I actually don't have any concerns about ever having kids who see my, you know, more raunchy or risque or disturbing stories.
No, by the way, it's not the kids you worry about. It's the kids' parents. Just so when you get to that point, you keep that in mind. That's the problem. It's not the kids. It's the kids' parents.
All my friends are other writers or, you know, involved in the entertainment industry. So I don't think it'll be a problem.
All right. Well, speaking of young people, one of the things I was curious about was why don't young people – young people your age, your brother's age, why don't they get more into short stories? I mean, this is a generation, or the last two generations, actually, that have basically been formed by the, not necessarily MTV itself, but the whole idea of MTV, short nuggets of information, things happen very fast. I mean, the reason I liked your short stories is that things happen fast, there's a lot of dialogue, there's action, it's colorful. It's the kind of thing that I would think that would appeal to this generation. But we haven't seen this huge resurgence of short stories.
Yeah, I would say one reason is just that reading in general is not – it's just not the healthiest form of media right now. I mean, to me, the healthiest form of storytelling media is TV right now for whatever reason, mm-hmm. Well, for a lot of reasons. Another reason I think has to do with the short story itself, which – has become this kind of niche literary thing where people don't really write stories in the stories. They'll be vignettes, not mm-hmm. stories. So I feel like the average book of short stories that you pick up, you know, it's a story about like a guy opens a piece of mail and it prompts him to remember something. And, you know, he reevaluates his life while sitting at the kitchen table. I can understand why that's not appealing to your average consumer of media and stories. I've never really liked stories of that nature either. So when I write a short story, I try to tell a complete story that in theory could be the basis of a film or a novel or something that's just condensed. Hmm. So I feel like short stories could make a resurgence, could be meaningful to a younger readership, but it just hasn't, you know, there hasn't been anything close to a tipping point.
Have you produced any work that's been released as a Kindle single, that kind of thing, where it's just like a, you know, $1.99?
I know people have totally interested in doing that. I think the possibilities of e-media and, you know, the Kindle and iPad reader represent are really exciting. I'm working on a couple new things right now, and I'll probably finish once we're done writing the show. But I've definitely looked at that as a possibility.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you, there were two characteristics that I thought, well, that I found fairly consistent in these stories, many of them anyway, is that there's always a very aggressive protagonist. And mm-hmm. then there's also a rather aimless young person who doesn't seem to fit in with their family, with their friends, with work. I mean, they have a life, but they have no life. They're not going anywhere. They're not doing anything. And when these two worlds collide, that's when the action happens. Is that a fair observation, or am I off the rails here?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, the stories are very different, you know, but that is correct. And I feel like those are both sides of my personality. I mean, I feel like, you know, I've been very fortunate to find work as a writer and make a living as a writer, but always I felt that, you know, it's not a realistic career path, right? Even now that I'm doing it, I feel like it's not a realistic career path. And like at any moment, it will go away. So I kind of feel like I've aggressively sort of pursued you know, writing and my goals, but at the same time I have this ever-present fear of being like a listless person who's drifting, and I've never thought about the stories that way, but that's totally accurate.
Well, you're welcome for me planting that in your mind.
That'll be self-conscious when I write.
Now, the other thing is that, obviously, and you mentioned this, I mean, there's a lot of, for lack of a better term, genre fiction in what you do.
Yeah.
There's aliens, there's transmogrification, to get into a little Calvin and Hobbes language there.
Calvin and Hobbes was one of my biggest influences, actually. I think I was reading Calvin and Hobbes when I was, you know, 5 or 6. My grandfather would give me the books when I was a little kid. And I was telling somebody recently that I feel like if I had to distill what my influences are, it's like Calvin and Hobbes and the Marquis de Sade. You know, it's those two.
Bill Watterson would be so proud right now.
I know. I should track him down and find him and thank him. He'll be so grateful because he loves fantasy.
I'm sure. Well, and so you answered my question. I was thinking, well, you know, where does that come from? Now, what about, you know, in terms of – well, no, I guess that covers the Marquis de Sade covers the other side of it, yeah.
The genre influence is – and that's the stuff that I read when I was young. Like Bradbury, Stephen King was a huge influence. But I've always been drawn to character-based stories too. So I don't feel like – I don't really consider myself as a strict genre writer, but those elements always seep in.
Mm-hmm. Can a writer make a living writing short stories these days, or is it part of your overall what you're doing? I know you're doing TV work,
not.
And we're going to talk about that. But no,
absolutely not. You can't make a living as a short story writer. Maybe there's like one or two people who do it, but actually, there's probably no people who do it. I guess Alice Munro did it. And, you know, maybe William Trevor. I'm not sure. But no, I write fiction and short stories because I love to do it. I've always done it. Even before I knew how to type or write, I would draw pictures. But I absolutely 100% make my living as a TV writer.
Okay. Have you had any luck optioning any of the short stories to TV?
Somebody's actually making a short film of the Girlfriend Game short story. I believe they're shooting in a week. I wrote the script for it, and they're putting it together and casting right now. I'm only involved as a screenwriter, and I'll go visit the set and watch. But I'm very excited about it. It's cool.
I thought the stories. I really enjoyed the book, and I thought the stories that would make a good. Kind of like a rolling kind of a Showtime or HBO or Stars, I guess, is getting into that now, where each week it's a different story. I'm trying to think, there's a term for that, and I just can't think of what it's called.
An anthology series.
Thank you. Like Amazing Stories was years ago.
That would be great. I used to love Tales from the Crypt, obviously Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, even the rebooted Twilight Zone was mm-hmm. fun. I like anthology series. I don't know how well those sell. But, you know, most shows now are serialized, but I think that's a very cool idea.
Hmm. Well, you've got that horror element, and I think when it comes to that kind of show, that tends to be what does sell. You know,
yeah.
Happy little Steven Spielberg stories didn't really go, but yeah. Tales from the Crypt, you know, went for years.
Yeah, I think somebody's going to sell one of those sooner or later. I feel like that – because that's happening in movies right now. There's VHS, ABCs of Death. These movies have come out and done very well, and they're all anthologies. I think they're doing VHS 3 now or maybe even 4. I feel like somebody, you know, they're shopping versions of those out to TV.
I was kind of surprised that you didn't say that. I'm going by memory. It's Mammals, right, with the dog?
Yeah.
That seemed to me like the one that would be most likely to be optioned, especially in this climate today with, I mean, horror stories are just, you know.
Yeah, that would be a fun short film. That would be pretty dark.
I could see that as a full-length film, frankly. I mean.
The ending might be too, I don't want to give it away, but the ending might be just too, you know, you have to come up with some more twists. I would have.
Yeah,
But yeah, that's cool.
All right. Well,
there's a couple others too. I mean, I want to see how this short film. I want to get through the making of the short film of the Girlfriend Game itself, and then I'm gonna look into adapting some more of them.
Cool. So we've kind of followed a little winding road here to get to your TV work. How did you get involved in TV? What was your first gig?
So I was actually working in finance in New York years ago, and I was there during the financial collapse of 2008. And then I left after that because I was just, you know, I was writing in my spare time. I published a couple novels. And at a certain point, I was like, I gotta do something else. And TV was very exciting. I had no idea how to get into it. You know, some people had sort of suggested it, like, you should try that. And I was like, that's like, you know, writing in Sanskrit or something. I just have no idea how it's done. And then I sat down with a friend of mine, a YA author named Ned Vizzini, and he had similar thoughts. And we started talking about a few ideas, like maybe we should try and write a TV script together. It'd be easier if we pair up. Mm. And we went to my apartment and we were just kind of pitching ideas. And very, very quickly, it was clear that we had something. So we wrote a script. And we, at the same time, because we still didn't know how to write TV at all. Mm-hmm. So we were just watching pilots and diagramming them and taking them apart and trying to teach ourselves. And we did that for about 2 years. And then we moved to L.A. And started trying to get meetings. We had agents through book agents. They had recommended us to TV agents. And we got hired on the second season of Teen Wolf on MTV, which was a pilot that we read when we got out here before the show had ever gone on the air. We knew it was really good, and we also thought it was kind of like an undervalued stock because people were like, what? They're making a TV show?
Right, yeah.
Like, Michael J. Fox thing? How? But we had a feeling that it was going to be really good. So we tried to get on it. We didn't get hired the first season, but they remembered us and called us in the second season. So we worked on that. And then after that season was done, we went to Last Resort, which was Sean Ryan's show. Mm-hmm. Sean had created The Shield, which was the show that first got me really excited about the storytelling possibilities of TV and made me want to do it. So that was very exciting.
Oh. You've worked on some pretty interesting stuff. I imagine I have not seen a Teen Wolf. I saw the original movie and liked it. You know, it starred that guy that who's now the old man with Parkinson's disease and right. And the sequel was that younger guy from Arrested Development, right?
I think, yeah.
Right. So, but I'm assuming most young people don't know it. But kids my daughter's age, I actually heard them talking about it recently.
Yeah, we have a very very avid, or I should say we Teen Wolf has a very avid fan base of teenage girls and adult women also, and it's actually a very, very rabid audience that's grown over the seasons. And the guy who created the show or developed the show and runs it, Jeff Davis, is really, really, really good. He knows exactly what he's doing, and he's got it all kind of planned out. We learned a lot from him. It's kind of like being in a workshop or a master class, because it's just, it's actually exactly the same feeling as being in a college class. You're just sitting around a table all day with like seven or eight people and talking about werewolves.
Can you share anything behind the scenes from that show that young people who love the show might like to know or might find, you know, fascinating?
I'm trying to think. The kid who plays Styles he came up with some dialogue and stuff for his own scenes. He was discovered off YouTube videos, I think. I don't know that he had done anything before Teen Wolf. And he's a fantastic actor, and he's going to be really, really big. He's already been cast in a bunch of movies. I don't know what else. I think it's probably all come out in various interviews with Jeff and the cast.
Any particular storyline that you were responsible for that you take pride in from that show?
None that I was solely responsible for, because The Room comes up with everything led by the showrunner. But one thing that we were really involved in and thought was great was the storyline with this character Isaac, who comes in the second season and is one of the new werewolves and has now become a much bigger character in the third season. But he he was like a teenage gravedigger, and you know, a werewolf attacks him. And we had great fun coming up with that episode. I think that was the second one in the second season.
Oh, that Isaac wasn't the bartender from The Love Boat?
Different Isaac.
Different Isaac. Sorry. Sorry, folks. I'm old. What can I say? I have too many old references. And then you mentioned Sean Ryan's Last Resort, which had a small but rabid following. I know my wife loved that show. She watched it.
Oh, cool.
Where do you think that show went wrong? Is it just why do you think it didn't work?
Well, here's one big thing, which we all knew going in. We had a terrible time slot. They call it the death slot. Like, literally, that's what it's called. You know, when the schedules were announced, the senior writers in the room were, oh, we got the death slot. Which is Thursday at 8 on ABC, and they haven't been able to launch a show there for a long time. But that aside, it was a challenging concept. What do you do on this island once the events of the pilot have gone down? I mean, they nuke Pakistan in the pilot. There's a rogue submarine. We had great actors, great characters, but because they're on this island, you have to import story every week, and there's a tough balance on network between being serialized and episodic. So we were walking a tightrope, and I think we pulled it off ultimately pretty well in terms of wrapping up the story, but it was a very, very challenging show to write. It was a great experience. It was a great, great room. Sean and Carl Gajdusek, the other showrunner, are terrific. And they're doing another show on ABC now. They just sold it and they're going to do the pilot. But both those shows were terrific experiences.
Yeah, I mean, generally, I'd watch anything that Andre Brouwer is in. He's amazing. But the concept, I just couldn't wrap my head around watching that. It sounded like it'd make a great 2-hour movie, you know. But I just couldn't see following that week to week. I just didn't. I don't know.
Among our best assets were the lead actor. Andre Brouwer is an amazing guy. He's really, really smart, and he has that imposing presence.
Oh, yeah.
We would go to set to produce our own episodes, which is nice when you're shooting in Hawaii. But Andre is there, and he's in, like, his regular clothes, not the military uniform, and he is just as imposing, you know. He's like, he looks like, writer! And you're like... But he is one of the smartest people that I've ever worked with. He's awesome.
All right. Well, and finally, let's wrap up with what is probably one of the most exciting credits now is you're working on a new J.J. Abrams show. Believe, which I think you told me will join NBC after the Winter Olympics, February, March 2014.
Yeah, I believe it's March 9th right now.
So, obviously no one has seen that yet. Tell us a little bit about what it's about and, you know, your role in that.
Well, I can't tell you much because there's, the wall of secrecy. But I can tell you it's about a 10-year-old girl with supernatural powers that are growing and are kind of mysterious. And there is a death row inmate who gets broken out of jail in the first episode. And he's got to protect her from people who want to get her and use her powers. And beyond that, I can't say much. There's a lot of surprises coming up.
Sounds a lot like my origin story, frankly.
Are you the death row convict?
No, I'm the – no. not letting on to that, no.
The pilot was directed and co-written by Alfonso Cuarón, whose movie Gravity is coming out this fall. And he is obviously a fantastic artist. With him and J.J. Abrams behind the show, it's been really, really an incredible experience. And we have a great writer's room. We start shooting this fall, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Can you characterize the difference between working on an Abrams show and, say, a Sean Ryan show?
I would say they're more similar than different in that, you know, these are people who have made very successful shows. They know pretty well what they want, and they know how to run a show so that everybody's contributing, which is really the key thing and the most important thing in a writer's room is everybody brings something to the table. To me, it's just been kind of incredible because, you know, I only came to Los Angeles to start screenwriting about 3.5 years ago, And once you're fortunate enough to be allowed to get a seat at the table, you get to be in proximity to your heroes very, very quickly. Sometimes, to kind of see how these guys run their shows is just like a huge opportunity that I never thought I would have. And to kind of contribute to that is incredible.
Well, you've had a great run through, your 20s, I guess, right?
I'm in my 30s now.
You're in your 30s now. Okay.
I'm all grown up.
Didn't you say you got out of high school in like 2000?
Yeah.
All right. So you're pretty close there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. This is the year.
My math isn't so far off. Okay.
Yeah. I started on Teen Wolf when I was 28, which was good.
Yeah.
I felt like if I waited any longer to come out here, I would just be like behind the curve. So.
I could understand that. I could appreciate that. Well, folks, listen. You can find The Girlfriend Game, written by my guest Nick Antosca, in great stores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching the video, actually, if you look just below the video, somewhere down here, you'll see a cover of the book. You can just click on it right now, order it immediately, and have it, in a day to 3 days. They'll send it to you immediately. If you're listening, just go to MrMedia.com and click on the interview with Nick, and it'll be available to you there. Nick, do you have a website, Twitter, Facebook, any of that kind of stuff where people can find you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. Just search for my name, and I think I'm verified, so you know it's me. I'm pretty sure there's no impersonators on there. But, yeah, follow me on Twitter, and that's the best online portal.
Very good. Well, Nick, I really enjoyed the book. You've broken my short story cherry here on Mr. Media.
Nice.
I don't know how many more will slip through the cracks, but this was a good one. I'm glad we did it. And thanks so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Thanks, man. I'm very proud. It's a privilege.
Pleasure. You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media Radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest 2-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at Stitcher.com/MrMedia. That's Stitcher.com/MrMedia. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening.